Okay, so I find the question of suffering and the end of suffering clearly compelling. And a little later on, you know, we'll go through a more elaborate description of the Four Noble Truths and the Buddha's teaching about suffering and the end of suffering. But that really is the core. And what is amazing about it, even breathtaking, is that this isn't meant to be a theoretical exercise. This is about our lives every day. The way we feel about ourselves, the way we treat one another, how we respond to injustice, the ways that we feel capable, the ways we don't feel capable. In a way, you can almost say that the whole question of suffering and the end of suffering it's actually a combination of seeing external factors and the often overlooked and forgotten internal factors. You know, this isn't meant to be a kind of dictum that external factors don't work, because I think that's unrealistic and unkind. You know, some situations are so intense, they're so traumatic, they're so difficult. Other situations don't have that intensity or that kind of dramatic edge, but day after day, you know, it's very, very hard. And I think that needs to be honored and respected and acknowledged, that there are times in life, which could be in anyone's life, which are very, very difficult. So much so sometimes that it feels kind of miraculous that somebody survives, you know, that they get through it. And to in some way discount that, I think, is really off the mark, you know, especially of a kind of middle path approach. And the other side of things, of course, is the internal reality, which has to do with relationship. How do we hold things? What do we believe about this circumstance? Are we imagining it is permanent, forever, unchanging? Are we seeing it more as changeable, mutable? Do we feel isolated? Do we feel all cut off and alone? Do we feel connected to a greater truth about life and others when things are really hard? You know, it has to do with relationship. And this is a place, of course, of tremendous empowerment, because even in times when we can't do much, or certainly much right away, about an external circumstance, there's the enormous relativity of how we are responding to it, what we're bringing to it, what we're adding on, how we're projecting into the future or not, how alone we feel or not, how much compassion we can have for ourselves and for others in that moment or not. You know, so this is the arena of a lot of the work of meditation. And it's kind of fascinating, you know, because within the Buddhist tradition, at any rate, suffering itself is not considered to be redemptive. You don't get, like, credit for suffering. It's not like, oh, yeah, you've suffered, therefore, you know. It's how we relate to the suffering that is redemptive or not. Just as the way we relate to pleasure is a very interesting question. Do we allow ourselves to experience it? Do we cut off from it? Do we hold on to it? Can we enjoy it without that kind of grasping? That's a very compelling question too. And then there are all those neutral places where, you know, we're not being hit over the head with intense suffering or pleasure. It's just kind of like, eh, you know, a breath. It's like, ugh. You know, it's so ordinary. It's so nothing. But how are we with that? That's a big part of a day, really, you know, if we fall asleep or numb out or get into some kind of cocoon of disconnection whenever things are neutral. That's a big part of a day, which means a big part of our lives. We're just sort of numbed out. So how we relate to all of it, the pleasure, the pain, the neutrality, is the key arena of work, you could say, in the meditative traditions. Can we experience the pleasure that comes fully, completely, without that extra thing of clinging and grasping and trying to possess it and keep it from changing? Can we experience the pain and the difficulty genuinely, truly, with an open heart, with wisdom? Can we actually wake up and connect during all those neutral times that seem so ordinary? And of course, from the Buddhist perspective, we certainly can. Yes, we can do that. Because that's the nature of the whole methodology, is the transformation of our relationship to our experience. So, you know, as I've often said, as many of you have often heard me say, from the meditative point of view, what arises in our experience is not the crucial question. The crucial question is how we relate to what arises in our experience. And so from that point of view, you can't do it wrong. You're not failing, you're not sort of aberrant, you're not off the charts, because you're having a difficult experience, because you're falling asleep, because you're restless, because you're anxious. It's how we relate to all of these states that is the point of the transformation. You cannot be having a wrong experience. I mean, you may not want to advertise your experience in the paper, you know. I fell asleep and then I got agitated, and then, you know. But it's not wrong. It's just a conventional idea of what we should be experiencing and what we shouldn't be experiencing, which is, you know, it's incorrect. Within this domain, anything may come up. And the question is how we are with it. How much awareness, how much mindfulness are we bringing to bear? How much compassion is being evoked? So the experience itself is not a measure of, wow, I'm the world's greatest meditator, or, you know, I'm so bad. It's like beyond belief. It's not about that. It's the question of relationship. And we know this in a way from our lives anyway, kind of intuitively. Because we all know that we can be in a beautiful situation with loving people. We can be in Hawaii, you know, this waterfall behind us and rainbows filling the sky. But we're depressed, or we're frightened, or we're lonely, or, you know, we're have a sense of foreboding about something coming up. And we're not having a good time. Or we can be in a very, very challenging situation. But we feel this sense of connection to others. You know, we can sense them reaching out to us, and we allow ourselves to accept that. Or we feel part of a bigger picture of faith or community or love, something. So even in this really hard, hard situation, it's not the same thing. You know, because we have a kind of internal resiliency or buoyancy. So we know that. We know the great relativity of life, that mindfulness actually shows us a practical tool to be able to kind of remember that and approach our experience with that understanding. You know, mostly when something happens, our reaction to it is so fast and so strong. It's like they're one thing. But if we are very present with our experience, we see they're not one thing, actually. There's the arising of whatever that experience was, and then there's the reaction. If we think they're one thing, there's a sense of inevitability and permanence and absolutism, universality to that reaction, which is really untrue. And something could happen in the middle of this room, and some people would respond one way, and other people would respond another way. And each of us might respond differently every day. You know, if we had a good night's sleep or not, or if our luggage was lost by the airline or not. Or, you know, there are lots of factors that are coming into making up that moment's reaction that are not embedded, it's not wed to the actual arising of the experience. And if we're mindful enough, we see the arising of the experience. There's a space. We see the arising of the reaction. It's not that we never have a reaction, but we can see it for what it is, as conditioned by many, many different factors. It's like the other week, I was, the other month, actually, I was teaching in New York City. I was going to teach that night. And somehow in that afternoon, mysteriously, my cell phone stopped ringing, And I didn't realize it because it also wasn't like beeping with a message. I was supposed to meet a friend somewhere and she was incredibly late, and as far as I knew, she hadn't called me and hadn't left a message. And every once I'd look at my phone and think, huh, no message, that's odd. You know, and like an hour late or something, she showed up and said, I called you four times and I left four messages. And then I, you know, kind of went into my cell phone and I realized, oh yeah, it just hasn't, it stopped making sound for some reason. So then of course I spent like 2 hours, you know, trying to like reset the cell phone. And every time I set it to normal, it still didn't make any sound. So that was distressing because of course we are completely dependent on all of these things. Or at least I am these days. So then I went off to teach at night, that night. And in the middle of the evening, someone's cell phone went off. And, you know, they were very embarrassed and other people were kind of annoyed. And I said, no, wait a minute, you know, like, here's a perfect example. You know, there's the sound of the cell phone. Some people are annoyed. The person whose phone it was quite embarrassed. I felt quite envious, you know. I was sitting there thinking, wow, their cell phone works. How come my cell phone doesn't work? That would be, and not only that, they had a really good ringtone, a much better ringtone than I had, even when my cell phone did work. You know, and isn't it this way, actually? But we don't stop very often and just take a look and realize, wow, that annoyance is not kind of the only forevermore reaction everyone will always have and must have to that sound. Life isn't like that. It's moving, it's changing, it's evolving all of the time. So this is very important because there is so much we cannot control in the unfolding of our lives. Things come and go, people come and go, seasons come and go. There's a rising and passing away, there's birth, there's death. And yet how we are with all of this is the it's the whole arena of our work, our practice. And here's the place of creativity, here's the place of aliveness, here's the place of possibility. It's not just to like feel a little better in a bad time. It's incredibly vibrant. Because with another relationship to what's happening, there is also the possibility of tremendous learning and insight and clarity. You know, if something comes up and we're so busy struggling against it and we resent it and we hate it and we want to push it away, or we hate ourselves for not having been able to avoid it or whatever, there's not a lot of learning. Because the environment isn't there for learning. If something comes up and we're just swept up in it, you know, and then the next thing comes up and we're swept up in that, so that we don't have a sense of being centered, of being connected, of being grounded in that moment, of having any space in that moment, there's also not a lot of learning. It's just not going to happen because we're just buffeted, you know, by all these things that come and go. So we talk about trying to establish a relationship to our experience, all of our experience, pleasant, painful, neutral, that has some balance to it, so that we're not completely overcome and we're also not aversive and pushing away and struggling against it. And in that middle place, that place of balance, is the birth of insight, seeing really clearly the nature of our lives. This moment's experience, our connection to one another, the reality of things. You know, when we're lost, say we're full of aversion or anger towards what's come up, it's not usual in that moment that we remember the truth of change. You know, it's much more a sense of this is it and it's going to be this way forever. And when we're in that state, we're just lost in a world of projection. It's not very often that when we're frightened or we're angry that we retain a sense of possibility. You know, if we're very afraid, we don't usually think, well, if it doesn't work out this way, maybe it'll work out that way. That's not the mind state. It's a state of shutting down, of tunnel vision. And so all of those reactions in a way distort reality for us. And when we're lost in them, we can't much see how things actually are. So we work to have a greater sense of balance, more presence, more ease in our relationship to what's happening. And out of that relationship will come wisdom, will come understanding, will come clear seeing, which is very powerful. You know, it's not just to feel a little better. It's not even just to have a healed relationship with our experience, but it's because that's the platform for wisdom that we do this work. And out of that wisdom, which comes from our own clear seeing, we then respond very differently anyway. You know, we deeply, deeply know the truth of change or the universality of suffering. It's not just me. You know, things like that. We're different. We are transformed more in our lives as just an ordinary day goes by. So this is our practice. This is really what we're doing. The techniques, the tools are often very, very simple. So simple that they seem kind of simplistic. But they're actually very powerful. When I first began meditation practice, it was in India in January of 1971. I'd gone in 1970 as a college student, my third year of college, to try to learn meditation. And I wasn't interested in sort of becoming a Buddhist or naming myself anything or rejecting anything else at all. But my sense from my little bit of exposure to Buddhism was that they were very practical tools and that they could be used to change one's life. And so when I went to India, it was with that very much in mind. And I first meditated, as many of you have heard me say, in an intensive 10-day meditation retreat. When I walked into those monastery gates, I'd never meditated for like 10 seconds before in my life. And the very first instruction that I received was something very similar to what we just did in the sitting, which was sit down and feel your breath. And I was quite startled. I thought, feel my breath? I came all the way to India, you know? Like for something magical and esoteric and mysterious and exciting that's going to completely transform my life. I thought, feel my breath, you know? But and I thought, how hard can this be? It was a big shock. I thought, okay, what will I be with 700, 800 breaths before my mind starts to wander? And to my amazement, it was one, you know, or a half or two. And I go far, far, far away into the past, into the future, way far away. And I was so appalled. You know, I thought, oh, this is so horrible. And I heard, I don't know, countless times that the critical moment in the meditative process is when you realize you've been distracted, because that's the moment we have the chance to be really different. Not to judge ourselves and not to be hard on ourselves and not to be harsh, to gently let go and simply begin again. You can go far, far away for a long, long time, but you can always, always begin again. And that really is what we're practicing, is the art of letting go and of beginning again. So I heard that many times, but of course I didn't believe it for quite a long time. And yet it's true that this is really the process. As we are deepening the force of concentration, which is almost like the foundation of the practice, what we're doing is we're taking that very scattered energy and just bringing it together. And then our minds go off again. It's okay. Taking that very scattered energy or attention, just bringing it together. And over time, there's a certain sense of stability. It's not that your mind doesn't wander or your attention doesn't wander. It will wander, I can guarantee you. But as one of my teachers, a Tibetan teacher, Sakyamuni Rinpoche, said, it's not the thoughts that are the problem, it's the glue. You know, the thoughts come and we, you know, we just glue onto them and we're gone for long, 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 long periods of time. That's what starts to change. There's still thoughts, but maybe not so much glue, you know? So there's more of an ability to kind of see the thoughts coming and going, things like that. You know, it takes time and it takes a kind of diligence to build up this concentration. And it's not permanent, you know. Unfortunately, you can't say, well, I did it, you know, it's done. But it's like a skill. It's a skill in coming back. It's a skill in starting over. It's a skill in balance, not trying too hard, not being lax, and so on. And we can strengthen that skill, absolutely. And that ability to be more present, more cohered, more centered, forms the basis of being able to develop mindfulness, which is that new relationship to what's going on. Not holding on, not pushing away, not falling asleep. Mindfulness is defined in many ways, but one way it can be defined is the ability to be with what's happening in the present moment without the intrusion of bias. In other words, say we've been historically afraid of certain emotions, and that emotion pops up. Can we be with the emotion in a different way rather than, you know, immediately shutting down and trying to push it away? If our tendency is to project unpleasant, painful things into an endless, seemingly unchanging future, can we catch that tendency and not be so overcome by that? Be with the experience more as it actually is in the moment. So if we can center more and have more of that sense of concentration, that's a great platform to open our attention and be with the many things that come and go in a different way. That is kind of the core strength of mindfulness.